through the Alaska Airlines studios.
This is Tom, Jake, and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Ross.
Hour number three of Tom, Jake, and Stacy. We are pleased to have Mariners General Manager Jerry DePoto here with us. Jerry, busy day for you. How are you feeling today?
Well rested. It's been a long off season, and we've been relatively dormant.
What's 2020 going to be about? What's the message to the fans this year? We know we're going to see a lot of the young players. What can we expect to see?
We can expect to see exciting young athletes. We can expect to see mistakes, and we can expect to see successes, and in a romantic way, first time successes that go a long way toward establishing players in a marketplace. So we have personalities. Guys like Shed Long and Jared Kelenic really stand out. We have huge potential. Guys like Kelenic, Julio Rodriguez, Kyle Lewis, and so many of them are descending on Seattle that either arrived toward the tail end of 2019, or we expect to be here before the end of 2020. Get on board and watch these guys. They're going to be here for a long time.
We just talked to Justin Dunn a second ago. We love who he is. We love his personality. When you're scouting these guys, how important is personality? You're not going to have a roster full of, you know, everybody's just electric necessarily, but how important is that for you to assemble a club like that?
It's huge. And in Justin's case, Justin's one of our most intellectual players. He's a smart guy. He was one of the guys that we had identified along with Kyle Lewis and one other player who we didn't get in 2016 as potential first round draft pick fits for us. And we got to know him very well, particularly our then scouting director, now assistant to me, Tom McNamara. We knew who Justin Dunn was. Smart. He looks through it. He's data centric. He's an athletic guy. He's played multiple positions. He wasn't just a pitcher in college, and felt like that combination of events really gave him the potential for blossoming after college, which has happened. I think his season last year was clearly his best as a pro. The fact that he got to the big leagues and especially after his first outing, which was a struggle, he got back on track and I think showed the character and resiliency that you want to see from young players.
I want to jump back into talking about the rebuild, but first, just a quick update. So it was Haniger suffered some kind of setback, a core injury, and will be out 6 to 8 weeks.
That's what we understand. This is all very new. Mm. We've just found out about it in the last 40 hours or so. We anticipate that Mitch is going to have a surgery to repair the core issue. It's likely to keep him out 6 to 8 weeks. Don't know yet quite what that looks like, but we expect he'll miss most or all of spring training. So his start of the season will be delayed, but we feel like the bulk of the season he's still going to be there with us.
At the risk of sounding insensitive to Mitch, because I know that's a painful injury, as we can all imagine, but we heard you mention before at your presser that may open the door for a couple of other young players, Fraley and Bishop. Are they ready to go here? I mean, were they expected to come up so soon?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Both finished the year in the big leagues. You know, Bish made our opening day team last year as an extra outfielder. Fraley, we called up in August last year, hit a phenomenal minor league season, about a 900-ish OPS, and stole bases, hit homers. He's a multi-dimensional player. And it's his time. Jake will play this year at 26 years old or 25 years old. Really good player. And we didn't get to see how good in the big leagues because he had some injury. But he's ready to go. He looks great in his postseason work. And we feel like he's ready to go. And he's going to get an opportunity. Bish will get an opportunity. They were going to compete for an extra outfield spot anyway. But we would like, if they are going to stay in the big leagues, particularly with Jake as a left-hand hitter, we would like them to play regularly. Giving young players opportunity once or twice a week isn't really opportunity, and we want to see them grow. So this opens the door for them, if just for an extra 30 days, to show us what they can do.
Tom and I kind of surveyed some Mariners fans on Twitter to see what they were most interested in asking you and talking about. By far, the two most popular things were one, the Astros, and number two, and I'll do this one first. They wanted to know, I have all this excitement about young players because that's what I'm looking forward to, but so many of them aren't in the bigs yet. So when can we expect to see some of those exciting debuts?
I think you're going to see a number of them arrive here in Seattle, if they didn't, at the tail end of 2019. So 2019, we saw J.P. Crawford and Justice Sheffield and Justin Dunn and Kyle Lewis and Jake Fraley. It was an exciting group. This next year, I think we're going to see a group at least that big. You'll see Evan White. I do believe you'll see Logan Gilbert, likely in the second half of the season. I do believe that there's a strong chance you'll see Jared Kelenic, because his talent is that big, that he will force his way in. And we want to make that happen. I think you'll potentially see Cal Raleigh. And I would be shocked if we didn't see guys like Sam Delaplane and Aaron Fletcher and Wyatt Mills take their turns here. We have such a special young group. And we do feel like we have an advanced group coming right behind them that is sometime a year after that, with guys like George Kirby and Brandon Williamson and the like. It's an exceptional group that I think somewhere between today and midseason 21, all of the guys we just mentioned, including Julio Rodriguez, wind up here in Seattle. And now we feel like the ball is rolling on a roster that has a chance to sustain championship-type play.
If Kelenic does make his debut, that, I'm assuming, then will be kind of a second half or in the back third of the season then.
To think conservatively, you know, yeah. He's just 20. He has 92 plate appearances above A-ball. So we don't want to assume that he's going to crash the party earlier than the second half.
Right.
But his talent says that's not impossible. And I will say his talent combined with his desire and confidence is there, it's really a pretty good cocktail. He is ready to be great, and he doesn't want to be an average player. He wants to stand out, and he's not afraid.
How does hitting frisbees off a tee help a major league hitter?
I wish I could tell you, but what you do have to do is you have to backspin the ball. And you know, in order to hit that kind of low tracer type of line drive, you do have to create backspin off the ball. And creating backspin inherently requires that you lift it and keep your bat on plane rather than rolling it over and top-handing a ball. So you have to execute a perfect swing to hit a ball like that. And then to hit a frisbee is a parlor trick that I found wildly entertaining. And I'm in. I said, either he is a budding Roy Hobbs or an awesome filmmaker. I'm betting on Roy Hobbs.
That is a crazy, crazy skill. It feels like every week, Jerry, we read online about trade rumors involving Kyle Seager. What's his role here? What do you think his future is, his immediate future is here?
I think he's our third baseman. You know, Kyle, at some point midway through last year, what was his midway point, having started the season late, he kind of morphed back into Kyle Seager after a little bit of a departure. Throughout his time in Seattle, he's been a metronome. You can rely on him to do the same things: play quality defense, super accurate throws, he hits for power, he makes good swing decisions. Kyle has been that kind of steady force here, and I imagine he's going to be that at least through the end of his contract. Well, every player, if they're associated with the Mariners over the last 4 years, has probably been in a trade rumor at some point. That's not what we're doing right now, and you know, we are focused on building forward. Kyle knows that if phone calls come in and people want to talk about Kyle, we are having conversations. But at the end of the day, my expectation is he will be our starting third baseman on opening day and throughout.
I have to ask, when you find out that the Astros are involved in this sign-stealing scandal, and you realize, whether you suspected something before or not, and you realize that you may have been cheated by a division rival, how does that make you feel?
No, I mean, I think it's a bad story for baseball, and I said it earlier today. It's a black eye on the game, but the only thing we can control is our response to whatever the event is. And I'm not a big fan of looking back and lamenting. Look forward is the only healthy thing we can do. The future of the Mariners is our future. We'll define it. We haven't cheated. We've not done anything. We've stayed above reproach in that regard, and we're going to maintain focus on this team and not look back on someone else's.
What do you tell young players? I mean, it's interesting that this is happening while you've got all these young players. What are you telling them about the future of sign stealing in the game?
We've had these conversations throughout the years, you know, because to be frank, sign stealing has gone on for decades, but not in a way that stepped over the line.
Right.
And we will maintain our integrity. That's the best that we can do. And we drive that through our players every day in so many ways. We stress character, we stress integrity in building our programs. And I think the players have responded in kind. They care about the Mariners, they care about each other, and we just want to grow forward. They'll do the right thing. That's our motto.
What was your last conversation with Felix like?
There's actually wished Felix well. And I recapped this a short time ago. Felix Hernandez is the greatest pitcher in the history of the Mariners. And as I said to him, you're probably always going to be the greatest pitcher in the history of the Mariners. And having I grew up a Mets fan, and Tom Seaver was my favorite player. And regardless of who came afterward, if it was, it could be Doc Gooden, it could be Jacob DeGrom, to really flash forward, Tom Seaver will always be the best pitcher in the history of the Mariners, or the Mets, because he was first. And that's Felix Hernandez to me. And you know, I wish him well. I think he will find a way to contribute. The last couple of years hadn't been great for him on the mound, but what Felix brought to this organization, what he brought to this city, what he brought to this fan base, and the way that they connect is special. And we saw it on his final day last year. And I said to him, you will always be a Mariner. You will always be welcome here. I think you know this is the end and where we part ways. And he said, I know. And I think that's right for us. It's right for him. He needs to go tell his story, and we need to tell the next story. And again, focus on what comes next rather than spend time focusing or lamenting what came before.
You know, I feel like a lot of the conversation, and it makes sense during before spring training, when we're all talking about development for a team that's rebuilding toward the future, that we're all talking about prospects. But is there a player that will be with the club to start this year that you're particularly excited to see more from?
Well, I mean, Evan White really stands out, yeah. Because I do think something would really have to, it would have to be a very rough spring training for us not to break camp with Evan White. I do think that there's a group of young relievers that come into spring, none of whom have pitched above double A, all of whom have an opportunity to impact our season. Sam Delaplane and Joey Gerber, I think, really stand out. Aaron Fletcher and Wyatt Mills are a couple of others. I'm excited to see what they do, because on a team that is very young, that is, we will line up as most likely the youngest team in the American League on opening day. In a team that is very young, we do anticipate introducing even more youth. So those four bullpen guys really stand out. Obviously, Evan. And with a guy who's been here, but I think we didn't get to see the real version of, I can't wait to see what a healthy, ready-to-go Jake Fraley looks like on the first day of spring training. Because you're talking about a player who, while not widely lauded as a prospect coming through, he's a second-round draft pick, who was a championship-type player in college at LSU, who's entered the pro game. And we've seen him do everything. He runs, he defends, he steals bases, he hits homers, he gets on base. And we feel like he's a catalyst waiting to happen. And I can't wait to see that start to transpire in the spring.
Mariners GM Jerry DePoto, great to have you in. We are super psyched for baseball to start. I know I don't even see any grass out on the field, but soon enough it'll be.
Imagine the grass.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks for joining us.
You got it, guys.
All right, Jerry DePoto, fun talking to him today. Fun being down here, actually, Stacey. Nice. I mean, we've been talking Seahawks, obviously, for months. They had a great run into the playoffs. Nice for one day to change it up and kind of to load up on baseball. That the stories that Rick Riz told us about 20 minutes ago, mm-hmm. I mean, those, thinking about seeing Griffey for the first time at some random minor league game, I mean, just, it, you know, it really does give you chills. And I'm not saying that they have the next Griffey necessarily in this organization right now. But look, if they go out there and they win a World Series and you stay faithful now, you will be able to remember back to the time when these guys were young kids.
Well, and there's still excitement to see this season as a fan. But I think what you'll be seeing is the beginning of some potentially great careers rather than, you know, great moments carrying someone into contention. But that's something you don't normally get to see. As a fan in the stands, you aren't usually out at spring training or, you know, double, triple A practices watching these guys right. throw the ball around.
You know, one thing I hope is told to these young players, and I forget if it was Service that said this last year or maybe it was DePoto, maybe it was another coach. There was somebody who said, you know, I wish my players would just go out and have a beer and just kind of relax once in a while.
Were his players like employees of some weird tech company?
No.
That really antisocial.
It wasn't that. It was that I think that because they were young, they were so concerned with their future mm-hmm. and like having all this pressure on them. The point wasn't to go drink alcohol. It was just to relax and make sure you have fun once in a while. You know, and I hope that message is properly sent to these guys too, because you don't want them coming up and all feeling like, oh God, if I don't succeed now, I'm never going to get another chance. I mean, I think that that's part of why Jerry DePoto gave Evan White this 6-year, $24 million deal to say to him, hey, look, we know you're good. We know that you're going to be with us at some point, hopefully the opening day. You're going to be part of our organization. Take this money, this deal, and relax. You don't have to go out there and act like every pitch you're trying to earn your job.
Yeah, no. And honestly, with that, there's a reason people say that confidence helps boost performance, is with that sense of self-assurance, but also immediate validation from your coaches. It's not that you're immune to criticism, but all of a sudden I'm not worried that I'm going to lose my job if I make a single mistake. You learn by making mistakes.
Right. In the old days,
it's not as fun to watch some mistakes when they get especially sloppy, but then you see some great moments too.
Yeah, you don't want to intimidate kids into, you don't want to be the manager sitting in the corner of the dugout spitting on the ground saying, all right, kid, you better prove yourself now.
You're like Tom Hanks in League of Their Own.
No, right? See, I kind of think Service should take the Belichick approach. All of a sudden, we see him with his sleeves cut off, his jersey out there looking real mad.
No,
why is he wearing a beanie? It's 85 degrees. He's wearing a headset? What's going on? Is that legal?
You know, hopefully, I mean, Service has been here for a handful of years now. He's had at least one or two decent teams, some really bad teams, veteran teams, young players. So in a pretty short time, just here in Seattle, he's seen it all. I hope he's learned how to manage different situations, younger players, older players. Look, I don't think it's going to be any worse than last year. Do you guys?
No,
other than I don't expect them to start with 13-2 or whatever.
No, but I mean,
which I don't even say that jokingly, but at the end of the season, though, those 11 wins helped them avoid a 100-loss season.
Right. How many did they end up having? 70 wins?
Curtis.
Whatever. Was it 70 wins, Curtis?
The Mariners had last year? It was less than that. I think it was 68.
Yeah, 68 wins? And 94. No surprise. Curtis nailed it.
Oh, my God. Well, hopefully it's better than that.
I would think so.
Here's the thing about wins and losses, too. You got to remember, a lot of that comes down to your bullpen, right? I mean, with starting pitching, the shorter and shorter outings that they're expected to have, a lot can change in late innings, obviously. We can talk till we're blue in the face about young players, but if you have a bullpen that's just thrown together and they, and Lord knows what's going to happen in the late innings, that could translate into a lot of losses. It could translate into a lot of wins if it works out. But that's definitely a big X factor for this year's team. Right now, let's take a look at what's on tap.
This is What's on Tap with Tom, Jake, and Stacey. So, folks, what's on tap?
The UW Huskies are welcoming in the reeling Utah Utes who have...
Yeah, they're on the road.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
Mountain road trip.
They're a road trip. Okay.
Tough mountain swing.
Utah is 1-4, though, since beating Kentucky. So they're reeling just a little bit. That could be an opportunity for the Huskies on the road. That'll be 5 p.m. on the Pac-12 Network. Elsewhere on our airwaves, 710 ESPN Seattle, at 7 p.m. it'll be the Cougs at Colorado. How have the Cougs fared?
Cougs are on a two-game heater. I mean, they beat Oregon, then they beat Oregon State with Klay Thompson, Steph Curry, and, of course, Zaza Pachulia in the house. But before that, tough road trip to the Bay Area. So,
what if the trick is to send Klay Thompson to every Cougar?
Well, he's available this year, right?
Right.
I mean, I don't know if they have the change to keep him, but he could just probably like net jet around.
Yeah, just kind of hang out and see how long that streak
toughest,
goes.
Toughest road swing in the Pac-12 conference here. You're going to Utah, to Colorado.
Ugh.
Brutal gyms, good student sections, high altitudes. This is going to be a tough place for the, as you said, Tom, the reeling Huskies to go in there and try to come out with even a split would be a win for them, I think.
Do you think Klay Thompson could win a game of one-on-one with a torn ACL against your average Coug?
Against, like, C.J. Ellaby?
Not Ellaby's a good player.
With a presently torn?
Yeah.
Like a recently torn ACL?
Well, not yesterday.
Okay, but, like, he's had surgery. He's recovered.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he could handle him.
You think he could beat him?
He was shooting some jumpers in Pullman, and if nothing else, I mean, he may not be able to plant and drive, but, I mean, he just needs to pull up, shoot some threes.
He could probably lay on the ground, take the ball, and then just shoot.
You're going twos and ones to 11, so he's going to just hit some twos, and he'll probably make quick work of a Coug.
You think he could hit threes laying on the ground? I feel like an NBA player could do that.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I think so.
I think he could probably do it from half court if he had enough
Lay on the ground
enough
half court and throw it.
Yeah. Jamarcus Russell throw a football 100 yards on his knee.
he's got a big arm.
You've never seen a cannon like that.
In the future, games are all just trick plays.
Oh, you know Clay Thompson get a half-court shot from his back.
It was worth 100 points.
So hopefully the Huskies can get it together tonight against Utah. Curtis, would you say that their tournament chances outside of the Pac-12 conference tournament, their tournament chances have faded away?
Yeah, they're struggling right now. I think Joe Lunardi has him in his next four out, not his first four out. So they're squarely on the bubble. They're going to need a couple of more big-time wins here. I wouldn't necessarily qualify Utah as a big-time win, but they've got two games coming up against Arizona. They've got at Colorado, their ranked team. So those are going to be their best opportunities to get some big wins here.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a road or a big win either, but it would be a win on the road in conference. I mean, it's something. It's better than nothing, certainly. All right, we're going to go around the NFL next. We've got a couple of good stories to get to. Tom, Jake, and Stacey, 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Tom, Jake, and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacey Rost.
For the teams that lose in the divisional round of the NFL playoffs, those teams are responsible, those coaching staffs are responsible for going down to the Pro Bowl and acting as the coaching staff. So Pete Carroll in Orlando, we heard Jake Heaps talking about him earlier, he and his coaching staff, and how the different players down there are responding to him. A couple of guys coming up to Jake and saying, man, is that guy like that every day? And sort of being, you know, it's just inspired by his general presence.
I'll tell you, as someone working in the media room, which I don't get to do as much anymore since our show's at the same time, but this hasn't changed. It's still happening when we're there on Thursday. But when you're in the media room working, it's right next to the auditorium where that fills the entire team, the big main auditorium. So that's where the basketball hoop is, where they go shoot and they have their shoot-offs and everything. There is like blaring music and competitions happening in there sometimes when you're writing. And in the moment, you're like, oh, come on, man. I can't even hear my headphones.
It is loud.
But then you realize how much fun that is. If you're a player on that team and it's the middle of the day and you're tired and you just finished or are about to practice, and then all of a sudden your coach is like, you know what, we're going to have a competition right now. Like, that's fun for
a
player.
It is, yeah. And evidently he's set up those types of, I won't call them facilities, but he set up the basketball hoops and that stuff down there, right? I wonder how much practicing or time together the team actually has with one another down there.
I mean, at least a couple of days, but it can't be too much.
I mean, what kind of plays are we running at the Pro Bowl?
What kind of offense do they install? It's like my second grade flag football. You got four plays. Run right, run left, pass right, pass left.
Can't be any.
All right, we're going run right on one. Ready, break.
Can you imagine one side just going all out, like a complete blowout? They're playing like 110%.
Yeah, because they had like the hardcore coach on the other side.
Yeah. Let's go!
Exactly.
Yeah, well, Jake did say that it was weird for him to watch Pete Carroll and this staff execute such a laissez-faire practice.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Because it's such a 180 from out at the VMAC in Renton, where they are screaming, yelling, music blaring, going crazy at all times, 100 miles an hour. And now it's like, pretty chill, bro.
What are you doing after this?
Right. So, see you at Universal later?
Yeah.
And go on the Tower of Terror?
Right on, man. I'll see you there.
Man. But you think that matters when it comes to free agency? Are guys going to be like, well, there's one unknown over here, or Pete Carroll, what I know what I'm getting into, had a blast with him for a week.
I don't buy that every player has a blast with Pete Carroll, though.
Oh.
Some guys are not his style.
I agree. But
it's impossible that every player would match up.
Even guys that left here. Michael Bennett said he was reading books. He cared so little about what Pete said at the end.
Well, yeah, but that's different. Being sick of Pete Carroll is different from your personality is not meshing to begin with.
There's a lot of different personalities in that locker room, though. I mean, it sounds like Pete Carroll is a personality type that works for instance, Dwayne Brown and, I don't know, like Mike Davis, who is more of a joker in the locker room. Like, those are two different personalities. So,
I thought all the personalities in the Seahawks locker room currently were the same.
That's kind of the conversation that I feel like we've been having, but personality-wise, there are different kinds of people.
No.
Okay, right.
Same.
Nope, sorry.
Same.
My mistake.
NFL says there were 224 concussions in the 2019 season, which is slightly up from 214 in 2018. That's not good.
What were the numbers? 220.
224 this year, 214 2 years ago. That's not good.
Yeah, but...
it's basically the same.
It's also down from 281 in 2017. I think it's... I don't think it's too much of a difference. I think concussions are always a story in the NFL, but one thing I think the league has gotten better about is reporting those concussions and being more diligent about when they see someone and they kind of forcefully remove them from the game. You need to get checked out. So I think you're going to see those numbers sometimes increase when they're being better about forcing guys to come out and get looked at.
That's true. We've seen enough guys go under the tent and then not come back.
Well, and you've seen guys that don't want to leave a game that are told, well, too bad. We need to check you out anyways.
Yeah, Russell was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of years ago in Arizona, I remember he went under the tent and then he suddenly threw it aside and ran out of it.
Yeah, was not happy with it.
They need to strap that tent down with like cinder blocks or something.
Make sure guys don't. I mean, I don't think guys, anytime a guy has to leave the field, you see guys look visibly angry.
Yep.
And it makes sense. You're at peak competitive mode in the middle of a game, and then you have to come out.
2015, they had 275. 2016, they had 243. 2017, from 281 down to 214, that's noteworthy, right?
From 281 to 214 and then back up to 224, I mean, it's a difference of 10 concussions. That's serious, but...
from 281 in 2017?
No, from 214 in 2018.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's a significant drop in the last 2 years.
It is.
What I mean?
Yeah.
I wonder what the biggest reason for that is. Is it kickoffs? Is it just that, like you were saying, they have more guys, more concussion protocol means more awareness, more...
yeah, like what kind of rule changes might have been connected to that?
Yeah, like it more preemptive action?
Yeah, it could have been also if there were rule changes... I don't remember at the time, but if there, whenever they required more of an independent practitioner on the sideline for some of those, maybe that led to an increase in reported concussions.
Yeah.
Because they were, you know, you're not a team doctor, you're an independent neurologist.
What kind of medical crew, I wonder, do they have under that tent? Like, can they hear each other over the noise of the crowd? Like, give me 10 cc's of penicillin stat.
Thankfully, I don't think they're doing like World War II-esque surgery.
It's like an army triage. They're only doing the hand motions. And give him some ether. He can feel it.
Give me the morphine.
Go, pump him up.
Suddenly, a player comes out with like a wooden crutch. Just lean on it.
An old Civil War stump on there.
With a patch over his eye.
What happened to him? Oh, a sprained ankle. That's all it is.
He'll be back.
Yeah, he's fine.
Just telling you, a lot of crowd noise be distracting. All right. This is the worst, well, not the worst story, but man, it's getting worse by the minute. An arrest warrant has been issued for Antonio Brown in Florida. He's been charged with battery. Evidently, he was throwing rocks at a delivery truck, and we just heard the audio of the 911 call made from the delivery truck or the moving truck to the authorities. He charged that Antonio Brown was high, and he was afraid of him because he couldn't do his job, obviously, with this wild man attacking him.
Yeah, it sounds like there
was a dispute.
I don't
know what the end game here is.
Yeah, I don't know. It sounds like there was a dispute about a delivery fee. Whatever it was, it's a messy situation, and it just continues to get more and more out of hand. I think a little bit has been normalized about it because it started out as something that I think people were just laughing about. Like when he was with the Raiders and then he left and he came out with that trailer, the joke was, wow, the production value of this trailer is phenomenal. Like that was
the thing that people were joking about. This guy's got frostbitten feet. Wow, that's kind of weird.
Yeah, and then now you look at it and you're thinking, man, is this guy...
I thought the same thing. Yeah. It has transitioned from, oh, this is kind of funny, like, wow, what's going on, to like, no one's laughing anymore. Yeah. And I saw a comparison made this morning of... you may have seen in the past couple of days the videos, pictures of Delonte West, the former NBA player who's now homeless.
That
he appears to be living
sad.
On the street. I mean, he's getting in fights. It looks like he's in a seriously unstable and dangerous situation. And just saying, this is where...
it's getting to
this
a
is two steps
slip.
Past yep. Antonio Brown. That you're going to see him. This is the path he's on.
You're getting to the moment of, are you going to start losing money with... like lawsuits or whatever other like fees and charges you're going to be leveled with. I mean, what's going on here? This is going down a path where, again, earlier in the show when we were talking about it, you always hate, it's hard not to as a broadcaster or someone who covers whatever field you're doing to, you do a little bit of armchair psychology once in a while because you're trying to talk about events that happen. And sometimes it is someone who it feels like a fall from grace a little bit. And it's hard to imagine someone so talented and successful and seemingly untouchable falling in this weird kind of way, and you're trying to make sense of it. And even though I try not to do that, you can't help thinking this guy needs help.
You know, well, and again, like I said before, Stacey, you're right. I try not to dig into the psyche of an athlete. I try not to read too deeply into body language, things like that. But when he, I won't say he was a model student, but he barely made a peep for the first 7 years of his career. And then in the last few, it got weird. And then in the last year, it got dangerous.
Yeah.
It got, honest to God, dangerous. So now I feel like he needs to be taken off the street before he hurts somebody else or he hurts himself.
You mentioned how quiet, stable he appeared during his time in Pittsburgh.
I mean, he didn't make any more trouble than any other your garden variety NFL player for a long time.
He certainly wasn't at this level, but it does beg the question of, man, what was going on in Pittsburgh? And does that organization and Mike Tomlin deserve more credit for keeping
something
that on the rails?
Right. Was this something that was
when
happening?
They had him and Emmanuel Sanders and
I don't know that they kept it on the rails, though. I think he was just fine for a while, and then suddenly he wasn't.
Yeah, I agree. It's taken a turn.
Man.
The Vikings have hired Gary Kubiak as offensive coordinator. Boy, he just continues to get passed around as coordinator, doesn't he?
He's a Super Bowl winning head coach. Future Hall of Famer, I take it by that measure.
Yeah, but I mean, running that offense with Peyton Manning, I mean, I could have done that, right?
Yeah.
Run right, run left, throw right, throw left.
Imagining Tom as an OC with just being like, I don't know, Peyton, whatever you think.
Yeah, whatever you think is good, bud.
Yeah, hey, man, I trust you, Peyton.
Yeah, whatever you want to do is totally fine with me. It's like choosing a restaurant when you don't want to choose a restaurant. No, whatever you want.
I'm really up for anything.
Yeah.
Why don't you order for us?
Yeah.
We sum it up next. Tom, Jake, and Stacey, 710 ESPN Seattle.
The wait is over.
They're going to wave him in.
It's time to sum it up with Tom, Jake, and Stacey.
Shot clock turned up.
The final word on everything that matters today in sports. Brought to you by Zone In CBD.
Step back!
We've had a great time down here at T-Mobile Park. We've talked to Justin Dunn, Mariners pitcher, GM Jerry DePoto, Rick Riz, Tom Murphy, Mariners catcher. And I, as a matter of fact, Stacey, I did a little writing of my own.
Did you?
I put something up at 710sports.com. It was the five moments that we should remember Felix Hernandez for. Now, when we're talking about a baseball player and moments they should be remembered for, usually those moments come in the postseason. They just do. All of Derek Jeter's do. He's probably got about 500 of them. But Felix never went to the postseason, so that's what we're dealing with here. I'm going to go through all five of them, and I've got two highlights to play.
Okay.
Number five, in August of in August of 2005, that was his rookie month. He listened to his innings pitched log. Ready? Five innings, eight innings, eight innings, eight innings, seven innings.
His rookie month.
Eight innings, seven innings, seven innings, then three. After his first six, seven starts, his ERA was 1.59. He burst on the scene and absolutely lived up to all the hype that accompanied his debut. And you know what? In 2005, that was important because it had been 4 years since they had been in the playoffs. They did have those 2 years where they won 93 games but missed the playoffs. But I'm sure Mariner fans were looking for some beacon of hope towards the future, and it arrived in the form of Felix Hernandez there. Curtis, here's number four.
Here's Felix Hernandez. First time swinging the bat this year. Here's the windup and the pitch on the way. Swing and a fly ball into deep right field. Chavez going back, and this one is gone. Goodbye, baseball. Felix Hernandez with an opposite field grand slam home run. Holy smokes, I don't believe it.
A grand slam for Felix Hernandez at Shea Stadium on June 24, 2008. Again, this came in the middle of another lost season. They were 26-49 at the time. Felix, though, was 6-5 with a 2.87 ERA. That was a pretty big game, given that Felix, this is interleague play when it kind of mattered, and it was ace versus ace. Felix Hernandez at Shea Stadium against Johan Santana, who was then the Mets ace. So for him to hit a grand slam at all, never mind off Johan Santana, was just a huge, huge deal. The number three moment I picked out was the last contract that he signed. By February of 2013, I thought a lot of us figured that he would end up in the Bronx as a New York Yankee, like basically every other superstar pitcher like him at the time probably would have. If they didn't end up in with the Yankees, it would be the Mets or the Angels or somewhere else like that. But Felix Hernandez agreed to a seven-year, $175 million contract to stay here. His quote at the time was, "I always say that this is my home. This is my life." And that meant the world to him. You could see him crying, and you could hear, see us crying because he decided to stay. He wanted to be in Seattle. It was terrific. Number two, in 2010, he won the Cy Young Award with a record of 13-12. That was something that previous to that point, that never happened. When it came to Cy Young Award voting up to then, it was usually who won the most games. Right now, wins are a stat we just sort of scoff at. But up until 2010, if you were a 20-game winner, you were likely to win that award. Not so much anymore. Felix changed all that. He was 13-12. He had a 2.27 ERA, 232 strikeouts, six complete games, a 1.057 whip. He absolutely dominated that year despite not getting much offensive support. That was a huge one for him. And, of course, number one, go ahead, Curtis.
One strike away from baseball history. Hernandez looks in, the windup, and the 2-2 pitch. Strike three called. Felix Hernandez pumps his arms in the air. Felix has just thrown the first perfect game in Seattle Mariners history. He's being mobbed by his teammates behind the mound. He's done it. He's done it. Felix Hernandez, a no-hit perfect game.
August 15, 2012, Salk and I were on the golf course that day. And as I was writing this up last night, I was trying to think, I was like, did we have smartphones that we could check scores on back then? And I guess we did, because at some point we realized that he was carrying a 1-0 lead into the ninth inning. So I'm not sure if it was like primitive technology or what, but somehow we figured it out. And the other thing was, we always made it a point, especially during day games, to watch Felix Hernandez starts just in the event that something special happened.
Yeah, and that was the one that you missed.
We were out on the. It was too nice of a day. It was August. We said, you know, let's just go.
I remember
golfing,
that
chance
day.
It. Where were you?
Well, I was just going to say, every single person I know, including myself, has a story of either A, they were at the game and how they got there, B, where they watched the game, or C, a reason they didn't make it to the game.
Exactly.
Every single person I know has a story of that.
Where
Mine's,
were you?
Yeah, mine is the latter, where there was someone with tickets at my job, and I didn't want to take time off. I was working late.
Would you have been here otherwise? Or would you have been watching the game? Okay.
No, I would have been here, and I didn't go, and I still remember it to this day. I couldn't tell you any other Mariners game that I could think of off the top of my head where I decided not to go but had a chance to go, with the exception of that one. And every single person I know remembers how they got to or missed the game.
I had the similar story, but everyone's got their story. I had tickets from work to go to that game. I got an email that morning that, because they were work tickets, that a client had asked for tickets. I had to give them back. So I had a ticket in my hand to that game. Ended up listening on the radio.
You could have gone with your media pass, though.
Yeah. Had I known he would have thrown a perfect game, I may have.
That's true.
It was like, take the tickets. I'll go find something else to do.
Kyle, he's going to throw a perfect game today. You should go.
Seems like kind of a hassle.
Someone on the text line says they passed up Diamond Club tickets for that game. That's a heartbreaker.
That's the beautiful thing about baseball, though. I mean, like, when it's a football game, we know where we were because we were all watching the game on Sunday. When it's baseball and it's essentially every day of the week, when you try to remember back to a specific day, you don't remember that.
But you'll never forget when you missed it.
No, of course
not.
Of course not. Hey, are we going to play a game show tomorrow? We are going to do that, right?
Pro Bowl trivia.
Let's do season.
Yeah, something like that.
We'll wrap up the 2019 season.
All right, we'll play a game. We'll have fun. We'll play games. We'll be back tomorrow. 710 ESPN Seattle.